Hello, this is Andy Bomek, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the January 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with a Mojo interview with Gillian Welch and David Rawling. Then, a review about the Bob Dylan movie titled A Complete Unknown, and a classic album review of Young Americans by David Bowie. And I start off with the Mojo interview. The lodestars of folk, old time, and Americana survived an actual tornado to deliver one of Mojo's albums of the year. Not bad for the Martians of contemporary music. Even in the folk world, we were weird, say Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. The leaves are beginning to change color. It's starting to turn into fall. Gillian Welch gazes out the window in the living room of the East Nashville house she shares with musical and life partner David Rawlings. I can tell, she tells Mojo, it's going to be a little bit hard to pack the suitcase, lock the door, and leave. Any day now, Welch and Rawlings will be back on the road, touring behind their latest studio album, Woodland, one of Mojo's favorites of the past 12 months. It looks like being a long tour. They might even make it to the UK in late 2025. Welch, who spent much of her life in Southern California, and Rawlings, raised in a former mill town on Rhode Island, the other side of the U.S., moved to Nashville more than 30 years ago and didn't leave. Their neighborhood, these days the hippest place in Tennessee, was considered the wrong side of the river when they arrived in the early 90s. Welch and Rawlings were on the wrong side of Nashville country too. The duo of acoustic guitar players, one rhythm, one lead, enthralled by old-time and bluegrass music in the age of Garth Brooks. See them as they were then, perhaps playing one of the bars or songwriter circles or remote folk and bluegrass festivals where they honed their art, you'd likely label them Americana, very young musicians playing very old music, sometimes with a post-punk mindset, other times purist. But in 1992, when Welch and Rawlings arrived, Americana was years away from being a genre, let alone the big business it is now. The music Welch and Rawlings devoted themselves to included the Stanley Brothers, Bill Monroe, Lefty Frizzell, John Hartford, deeply human music with its elemental themes of love, death, pain, and loss, but joy too, and making it through, says Welch. The same themes appear in Welch and Rawlings' original songs, seamless yet painstakingly crafted updates on the tradition illuminated by the pair's haunting harmonies. Including their debut revival in 1996, they've made 7 studio albums, the first 5 credited to Welch, and collaborated on 2 Dave Rawlings Machine records, plus a solo David Rawlings LP, Poor David's Almanac. Taken together, there are few auteurs in modern music as consistently awe-inspiring. Though they rightly balk at labels, the couple's importance in the world of old-time folk and the nascent Americana movement can't be overstated. For one thing, there's their involvement in O Brother, Where Art Thou, the Coen Brothers movie that Welch acted in and whose soundtrack, co-produced by Welch, broke the whole Americana movement wide open, introducing bluegrass greats from Harry McClintock to Norman Blake to countless young musicians and music listeners. Yet in 2020, their output was halted when a tornado ripped apart their East Nashville studio, Woodland, from which their latest album takes its name. Restoring it and their creative lives has taken years, but as Rawlings concedes, considering the 25 dead and 309 injured, they may have got off lightly. Obviously, there's lots of reality in it and a lot of cost, emotional and financial, but many people have dealt with much worse, Rawlings says. We've got Woodland rebuilt enough that we're working in it again and moving on and trying to make art. I couldn't feel more fortunate, actually. A theme to which our conversation shall return. How did you two meet? Gillian Welch, in school, Berklee College of Music. It was predominantly a jazz school, but there was one country band. If you had any notion of wanting to play folk or bluegrass or country music, you had to audition for this band. Dave was auditioning as a telly player, and I was auditioning as a singer, because you couldn't really audition as an acoustic guitar player. David Rawlings. We were sitting out in the hallway, kind of waiting to do the auditions, and that's when I met Gil for the first time. How did the audition go? Gillian. We both got in, and that was the first time we played together. How evident was folk and country in the music you grew up upon? Gillian. I'm kind of a hippie. I grew up in a kind of hippie school, so I knew all these folk songs. I loved rock and roll, and I always tried to figure out how to make sense of these two opposing things, folk music and rock and roll. I was living in a house with a bluegrass DJ named Mike McKinley. He's a mandolin player, too, and he had a great record collection. One time, I wanted to take a bath, which required scrubbing the tub. So I was down on my knees, scrubbing, when Mike put on a record. It was the legendary Stanley Brothers Recorded Live, Volume 1 and 2. And it just hit me how gnarly their sound was. The subject matter was dark and hardcore, and tragic and funny. And their harmonies were piercing, like a penny whistle when it goes into your ear like an ice pick. But you love it. I got up almost in a trance. I had to see who this was, and I saw that it was the Stanley Brothers. And something in me decided right then. I realized that anything I had been searching for in punk or in rock and roll was possible in acoustic music, and suddenly I knew what I was going to try to do. So, a big moment? Gillian. It was a big moment. I didn't really do anything about it for a while, but in my heart, I just started moving towards this kind of music and listening to it all the time and going to festivals and seeing people who were standing up there and doing acoustic folk music. People like John Hartford, and writing and playing and telling stories, showing people the world as they saw it. That was important to me. David, did you have a similar epiphany? David, I found my way to country music like a lot of people did via Dylan's Nashville Skyline. And there was this moment when I was a kid listening to the radio where story songs, folk and country songs kind of pushed through the mainstream, like Jim Croce and Neil Young's Heart of Gold. Then I drew the line to Towns Van Zandt and the Leuven Brothers. I learned all the words of the songs. I didn't play an instrument, but I would sit and fish and sing these songs in my head. But there was something even further back, and I discovered the brother team stuff, like the Stanley Brothers. How did you go from Berkey Country Band to folk duo in Nashville? Gillian, we had been going out, but we didn't move to Nashville together. I moved to Nashville because I had my plans, laughs. I didn't even really ask him if he was going to go too. I sort of forgot about that. He reminds me now and again. I knew I wanted to be in Nashville, and I guess I didn't want to have any discussions about it, so I just moved, and he came a month later. It wasn't until we got to Nashville that we started playing together. The first time was in Dave's kitchen. That would have been the first time we played as a duet. Dave, there's no stopping Gillian. Her plan was to go to Nashville and try to be a singer-songwriter who wrote songs for others and hopefully for herself too. I was in my second big country band playing around the Northeast, just a young kid playing guitar. So Gil was here quite a few weeks before I was able to move down. How did your plan go, Gillian? Well, I was brought up in a musical house. My dad was one of Barbra Streisand's vocal coaches and the arranger for her first big TV performance. So she was around and other people. My mom used to sing with Benny Goodman's band. I think I kind of took that for granted because it was just part of the fabric of my life. I spent so much time in my bedroom playing through songbooks. But it was just what I loved. I hadn't thought about trying to make money from it. I was kind of shy, and I had to get over that. Dave was really helpful with that. In what way? Gillian. Well, he had quite a head start on me, performing-wise. He'd been playing in bars, bands, all through his late teens and early 20s. And he had more Friday and Saturday night performance experience than I did. He said, you just have to play all the time. You have to go to every writer's night 3 or 4 times a week. He said he would go with me, play a mean guitar with me, if I would go and sing my songs. That's really how I got over being shy about performing. Why a duo, not solo or a band? David, I think it had to do with that early duet-based music we liked, like two brothers. Also, we heard something in our music, when just the two of us played, that we didn't feel got better when we played with other people. A kind of ebb and flow to the timing and a harmony blend when it was just the two of us. That was something special. Performing, it seems you know intuitively what the other will do. Gillian, they didn't tell me this until quite a bit later, but the first time my parents saw Dave and I play together, they were kind of freaked out because they'd been in the music industry for 50 years and they'd never really seen a duet with this weird nonverbal connection. My dad said he was honestly spooked, so I guess it was there from the beginning. Around Revival, your 1996 debut, you got in an old car and toured folk and old-time festivals. Did you meet anyone of your age taking a similar path? David, if I'm forced to look back, something I don't do very often, you understand that when you're young, you have this love for music, and no one's telling you anything's right or wrong. It clearly wasn't a good idea to try to make music that sounded like this old brother team stuff in the mid-90s. No one wanted it. But you just have to do it because it's what you want to do. Gillian, I have a vivid memory of playing the Newport Folk Festival. We played, as we still do now, on our two guitars. There was a woman watching from the side stage, and it was perfectly obvious who she was because she looked exactly like her father, Nora Guthrie, Woody's daughter. She was smiling, but she had tears in her eyes. After our set, she hugged us with our guitars still on and basically said, "Do you realize you're the first people I've seen here this weekend play acoustic guitars?" In the mid-90s, folk music had drifted so far that the majority of the bands playing the Newport Folk Festival were electrified. Even in the folk world, we were weird. "How did that make you feel?" Gillian, "Pretty out of step." This was partly why we felt more at home in the bluegrass and the old-time world, except that our subject matter and our poetry was a little bit on the fringe for the bluegrass world. "Did the old bluegrass players give you any grief?" Gillian, "No, they were very loving, and had open arms. But we knew that we couldn't just plant our flag there and say, 'Hey, we're bluegrass.' For one thing, because we weren't bluegrass in the specific recipe, we were kind of old-time, but we didn't have a fiddle. We didn't have a traditional lead instrument, so the best fit for us at the time, begrudgingly, was folk." Was there a "people are getting us now" breakthrough moment? David, "I wish I had a watershed moment, but it's like everything else. You gradually gain confidence as you play shows, and people want an encore. And because we were very efficient, and I didn't require very much, it was very cheap for us to tour. So we were making a living from the beginning. Some of our early trips to England were good for us, knowing that our music had traveled overseas, and there were people there who liked it too." Jules Holland had you on his Nashville show. David, "Jules Holland at the Ryman Nashville Live, part of BBC Two's Country Night, January 25th, 1997, was a big deal for us. We were very young and couldn't believe we'd gotten on that bill. There were a lot of established country acts who went on before us, and every act wanted to replay their songs. We were scheduled to play at 10:30 p.m., but it ran over and over, and by the time we got to play, the Ryman was pretty much empty. They sent people down to Broadway to get people off the street they could shoot behind to make it look like a live show. I remember Gil and I walked on that stage at 2 a.m. The Ryman back then sounded like perfection for acoustic music, so singing was amazing. I thought, this is a big TV special, and we're probably not going to get used. But when they edited the show, they put us in prime time. It had a huge effect. Afterwards, our record started selling over in England. That was a big moment for us." The huge success of 2000's O Brother, Where Art Thou movie and soundtrack seemed to change everything. All for the good? Gillian, "It was completely positive musically. I was so happy that these musicians that I absolutely revere and was inspired by and couldn't love more were thrust into this international spotlight, and that I had some part in facilitating that. People like Norman Blake, Ralph Stanley, John Hartford, the Fairfield Four. I mean, come on. The fact that tens of millions of people were buying this record, I thought was appropriate. I don't know how they missed it in the first place." David, we felt really good that our record collection became the best-selling record of the year. We spent a lot of time working on that soundtrack with T-Bone Burnett. T-Bone knew the Stanley Brothers, but he didn't know Ralph was still out there playing. After that, you couldn't move for indie folk bluegrass bands. How did that affect you? David, that soundtrack was coming up to 2 years' work. Then they wanted us to tour Oh Brother Everywhere. And I thought, we can't do that. We've got to get a record out. We've got to keep doing what we do, or we're going to disappear. So we managed to make 2001's Time, The Revelation, and really that established us like nothing before was Time, The Revelator, coming out when that Oh Brother energy was still swirling around. And here's a little bit of a song from the soundtrack, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? From Gillian Welch and Alison Krauss, titled I'll Fly Away. How do you go about collaborating on songs? Is there much negotiation? David, the process has been different with almost every song, as far as how they've gotten started and how they progress. Oftentimes, it's so difficult for us to come up with anything that we feel really good about. There's moments of debate, but it never really happens that one of us says, this line is good, and the other one says, no, it's not. I remember vividly working on Revelator, the song. We had gotten it to a certain point, but we were fighting with the lyric and the story and how it could possibly wrap up. But when those last two verses got written, it's like we both feel it. Songwriting is like carving. When you get to the core of it, you know you can't go any further. And here's some of that song, Revelator, by Gillian Welch.
Come and meet.
Jillian. At this point, I think we've written a song every way you can, including something like Annabelle on 1996 debut Revival, where I'd written the first verse, chorus, second verse. I had the music too, and had what you will know as the last verse and then another verse. I remember playing it for Dave, and he put his hand on the piece of paper and said, "You're done. Right here, the song is done." So that was a very early example of how great it is to have an editor and co-writer. Tell us about Hashtag on the new album, Woodland. Jillian, Hashtag got started when I woke up and looked at my phone and it said, Hashtag Guy Clark. And I knew what that meant. I knew that it was horrible news. The legendary songsmith died in May 2016. So the song got started that week. I wrote most of the verse material, the truck stops and the parking lots and the cheap motels, and then I just stopped. I didn't know where to go with it, and Dave and I sang it, and we couldn't figure it out. And then one night, he came home and sat down on the couch, and he got to the cheap motels and kept going. And his brain said, "When will we become ourselves?" And then we knew how to finish it. But you can see from the amount of time that elapsed that years went by. That happens with us. Years go by sometimes before a song can be finished. Here's some of the song, Hashtag, from the album Woodland by Gillian Welch and David Rawlings.
Face, I was walking in a new watering place. Been a little lost for a little while. People sometimes go out of style. Make a new habit, have a new kid. Maybe both, God forbid. But all at once you seem to know everything that laid me low. Caught it like a new form of the flu. Chalked it up to our old friend the blues. The questions and the answers you'd found talked me out of that breakdown. You said, time makes the wheels spin and the years roll out and the doubt rolls in and the truck stops in the parking lots and the cheap motels. When will we become ourselves? When will we become ourselves? You laughed and said the news would be bad.
David, it's a gigantic generalization, and there's many songs that fly absolutely in the face of it. But if we're going to play the averages, I think it's generally easier for me to look at where something is going and figure out where it needs to head. And I think it's easier for Jillian to confront a blank piece of paper and just start. But it doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, it's so difficult for us to write things that we feel like we want to play. We'll take it any way we get it. I'll stand on my head and spin in circles. There's no pride involved. Perfectionism? Jillian, well, I guess so, but we're so far from perfect. I'm just trying to get it to where I think it's okay. That's the same with David. We often talk about this. We say we're just trying to get it over the bar. I don't really think that highly of myself. Some of my favorite things that happen in songs and on recordings of ours are mistakes. They're unintentional. I didn't mean to do something that way, and in the end, it's my favorite part. What kinds of mistakes? Jillian. Well, they're all through Dave's solos, laughs. Though he's a very thoughtful player, and I can tell most of the time what he's meaning to do. Sometimes things happen that are unintentional, and it's just so beautiful. There are wrong notes and flat-out mistakes all through our records, but it never seems that important. We'll take vibe and storytelling and sonics over a flat note any day. David, nothing could make us happier than if we could write a record in a couple of weeks and put it out and have the world say, yes, this is fabulous. Doesn't that sound like a dream? But we just live in a place where we have to wait for the things that move and touch us emotionally and musically. Those are things you don't want to give up on, however difficult that is, and then they seem to resonate with the world. So if that means that it's a life's work and you have to spend the whole of your life doing it, so be it. In 2015, the Americana Association awarded you the Lifetime Achievement for Songwriting. Strange you would follow with an album with no new originals. 2020's All the Good Times are past and gone. David, how I think about Lifetime Achievement Awards generally is, what are you talking about? I feel like we just got started. I always feel like they're telling you they want you to stop. But the cover's record was unconsidered in every possible way. It was just after the tornado, and we were playing songs at the house, and I thought, why don't we record some of these and put out a kind of DIY project only on vinyl for a few thousand people. Jillian, our studio was destroyed. Our neighborhood looked like a war zone. It was like there were no people on the planet Earth. We would come back home, and all we knew to do was play songs that we loved. We were playing for solace and just to remember who we were. So much of my entire life had been obliterated. With the pandemic, we couldn't tour, we couldn't play for people, I was too completely freaked out to write. So we just played folk music, and it was such a survival response to us that we thought other people might want to hear the folk songs also. So Dave set one microphone on the coffee table, and we just sat where we'd been sitting every night playing these songs. Well, it wound up earning you the Grammy Award for Best Folk Album. How did it feel that while your albums of original songs were nominated, the gong went to your covers LP? Jillian, well, it's strange because I'm kind of known as a writer. A friend of mine told me it was the exact same for Dylan. His first album that won a Grammy was covers of folk songs. World Gone Wrong, 1993. So we felt in good company. I was so kind of out of it at the time, just not in the public sphere at all. And due to COVID, you couldn't attend the ceremony. So actually, when we won, I was out in my neighborhood picking up litter. And I came home with my bag of trash, and I took my phone out of my pocket, and there were like 47 missed messages. So that's how I found out we had won. What happened that day in 2020 when the tornado hit your studio? David, that was difficult. From the very first moment that the tornado hit, I was kind of running down the street, dodging through the power lines and the rubble and everything, and I could see that the building across the corner from us, The Family Dollar store was mostly down. But as I got a little closer, I could see behind it that Woodland was still standing. Most of the roof had been pulled off and was in the street in front of it, but it wasn't down. So I don't know how to say it, but my first feeling was one of relief, and I don't think it's ever fully left me. Your collaborations are most credited to Jillian, While a Couple, the Dave Rawlings Machine albums, and Poor David's Almanac are credited to David. The most recent two are credited to you both. What's the difference? David, generally the rule that we followed just for the sake of people listening was whoever was singing, we put their name on the cover. In retrospect, we probably should have just put both names on the cover from the beginning. There isn't much more thought in it than that. Jillian, in our household, we don't separate out those albums. The process is exactly the same. To me, we made those albums. We work exactly the same way. We just put his name on it. The generation of folk and Americana artists that you two were guiding stars for is getting on in age. Do you see young artists out there keeping the old folk music alive? Jillian, I feel that the music is very much alive and thriving. It's just everywhere. It's certainly all over Nashville. The days of Dave and I feeling like Martians are long gone, really. I really feel good about the state of the music. I hope that young musicians can feel the room to move within this music, that there are just vast expanses that you can inhabit. I feel so much freedom within the music. I don't always feel that within the world, but I really feel it within the music. And as long as that's there, I feel like it's going to be okay. Okay, here's a Mojo review of the Bob Dylan movie, A Complete Unknown. Ballad of a Young Man. Director James Mangold reveals all about his 1961-1965 Dylan biodrama, A Complete Unknown, plus Bob's thoughts on the whole thing. What I'm always looking for, says James Mangold, whether I'm making a Western or an Indiana Jones movie or a Wolverine movie or a Bob Dylan movie, is a fable of some kind. The director, whose credits include the Academy Award-winning Johnny Cash biopic, Walk the Line, Ford v. Ferrari, and various big-budget Hollywood franchise films, is discussing his forthcoming Dylan project, A Complete Unknown. The movie, set to open on Christmas Day in the U.S. and on January 17th in the U.K., stars Timothy Chalamet as Dylan and an ensemble cast that includes Ed Norton, Ellie Fanning, and Nick Offerman. Mangold, who penned the script with screenwriter Jay Cox, based on Elijah Wald's 2015 book, Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, singer Dylan, and The Night That Split the 60s, says his chronicle of Dylan's early career follows the arc of a classic tale. The idea of this 19-year-old with a few dollars in his pocket arriving in New York to meet his dying hero, Woody Guthrie, having written a song for him, and through that meeting, Pete Seeger, and finding his way into clubs in New York, and within 2 years ascending to a point of taking over the entire folk movement, that was really interesting to me as a fable. Critically, Marigold's vision resonated with the film's subject. When I first met Bob, recalls Mangold, of conferring with his subject, one of the first things he said to me is, "What's this movie about?" And I said, "It's about a guy who's choking to death in Minnesota, who runs away to the big city, leaving behind all his friends and all he knew, reinvents himself, makes new friends, makes a new community, takes it over, and then starts to choke to death and leaves. And Bob smiled at that, because I feel like that is the story. And that intrigued me because I knew I could make a movie about that. Mangold notes that Dylan's direct involvement with the project, A Lucky Break, due to a pause in his never-ending tour, brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic, helped shape the story even further. Bob had a tour that he'd just canceled, and he asked to read the script. And that was the start of our conversation, says Mangold. He liked what I was doing and saw that I didn't have some kind of agenda. Then we sat down and had a series of one-on-one meetings, four or five times for at least a half day, just the two of us drinking coffee. And it became a huge opportunity for me to fill in the cracks in the story that the many books about him don't cover. I felt incredibly honored to get a sense of his own perceptions of that movement so far away now. Mangold is quick to note that A Complete Unknown is not a biopic, but rather a film that focuses on a moment, specifically a five-year period from Dylan's arrival in New York City in 1961 to his going electric at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965. One of the things that I loved about this story is that it's a younger Bob for most of the movie that most of us have any memory of, says Mangold. I felt that gives you a lot more freedom than making a movie compared to the older Bob, where it's so known and completely out there, where you're competing with not only 700 books, but a dozen documentary films. Casting an actor to play Dylan proved relatively easy, as Mangold immediately tapped up up-and-comer Timothy Chalamet for the role back in 2020. Chalamet, whose star has risen since then with roles in the hit Dune films, remained the choice, even as production was delayed due to the pandemic and Mangold's other commitments. I thought he was perfect for it from the start, and remained so, says Mangold. Timmy's incredibly sharp, witty, ambitious, kind, and wonderfully odd and cool. And also, I felt he was hungry for a role like this. Plus, I felt he kind of could really embody a lot of things that Bob was, especially in that early time in his life. Mangold says that Chalamet subtly inhabited and evolved the Dylan character or characters. There are external consciousness which kind of extend to mannerisms and speech, but also wardrobe, makeup, hair, everything, says Mangold. But I think what Timothy was always after was growing him from position A to C, but also keeping them all. They're all the same guy. As Bob sings on his last album, I contain multitudes. Just as Joaquin Phoenix did in his performance as Johnny Cash in Walk the Line, Chalamet does his own singing as Dylan, a decision Mangold said was easy. One of the key components of a folk song successfully delivered by an artist is the emotional authenticity and connection with the words that fills the void left by less production, offers Mangold. Having said that, how could I possibly do that if I'm hitting play on a recording of someone else and Timmy was just moving his lips? While the film pivots around Chalamet as Dylan, the cast, which includes Norton as Pete Seeger, Monica Barbaro as Joan Baez, and Boyd Holbrook as Johnny Cash is equally important in telling the story. Mangold says his approach was influenced by the 1985 Best Picture Oscar winner Amadeus, directed by one of his mentors, the late Melosi Forman. In Amadeus, Tom Hulce as Mozart is the center of the movie and the wonder of the movie, Margot continues, but it's the weight he leaves on the king, or Solari, or his wife, or others, or the way he makes so many others feel so mortal, because their work doesn't quite hold the same candle as his. That was really relevant to me in building the script for A Complete Unknown. We need to see how much Dylan affects everyone around him. The thing that the movie touches on was that he made so many profoundly influential songs before he even turned 24. Even making the film, it dawned on me just what a motherload it was. Such a profound birthing of brilliant art. And knowing Bob's own restlessness and his own natural avoidance of being boxed in or categorized, I do think that's a clear undertow to the story as well. It's actually a line in the movie. What am I supposed to do? Do they want me to keep singing Blowing in the Wind for the rest of my goddamn life? Ultimately, Mangold admits that A Complete Unknown is just one part of the larger Dylan legend. I don't feel pressure to define Bob for the ages and all his work over decades. I'm just talking about the moment that this guy blossomed. He became empowered and then moved on. And where he moved to is either another movie or another writer's business, says Mangold, chuckling at the idea of a Marvel-esque Dylan multiverse filled with sequels and offshoot films. Well, nothing would surprise me in this world. And the classic album review this week is David Bowie's Young Americans, 1975. Released in March 1975, Young Americans represents the zenith of David Bowie's flat pack soul period. An often overlooked record, it nestles in the valley between the twin peaks of Ziggy Stardust and the Berlin Trilogy. While on tour in America in 1974, Bowie was seduced by Black American music and subsequently called his producer, Tony Visconti, to fly over from England and make a quick and dirty soul album. For his backing band, Bowie used a hybrid of his touring players, experienced sessioners such as bass legend Willie Weeks, and talented newcomers guitarist Carlos Alomar and singer Luther Vandross. Written mainly in the studio, the album shimmers in its limpid exuberance from the ostentatable banality of Right to the plaintive cry of Can You Hear Me? There is much to savor. And here's some of that song, Can You Hear Me? By David Bowie from his album, Young Americans. Don't talk of heart. The powder white aggression of Fame, recorded after the body of the album with Bowie's new best friend, John Lennon, is like a song version of Bowie's BBC documentary, Cracked Actor. And here's a little bit of that song, Fame, by David Bowie from Young Americans. The cover art reinforced Bowie's new authenticity and apparent accessibility. Gone was the stylized androgyny. Here he was looking straight at camera. Cigarette smoke crumpling skyward, a straight portrait shot suggestive of several decades earlier. Even the album's title clearly pointed to its target audience. Although Bowie has since enjoyed a schizophrenic relationship with the record and was to spend most of the rest of the 1970s courting the old world, Young Americans made him a superstar in America. And here's some of the song, Young Americans, by David Bowie.
Young American,
young American,
she wants the young American. prepared when the bags off the bathroom floor. We live for just these 20 years. Do we have to die for the 50 more?
And once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the January 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. It's going to be Mojo Magazine's Best Albums of 2024. And then a classic album review of Radiohead's In Rainbows. Until then, this is Andy Bomick for Mojo Music, saying so long. And keep rocking.
Do you remember the bills you have to pay, or even yesterday? Have you been a hung American, just doing your idle, simple, sentimental?